are now listening to The Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley. Somewhere between here and there, liminally speaking, this week is the first part of a 4-hour epic dialogue with the indefinable Dave O'Shaughner. So you remember when we first met, and I said to you something like, I can tell there's something different about you, but I don't think you're enlightened. And I can't remember, you know, how much I went into it, but basically I had an idea about an enlightenment and you didn't meet it. Mm. You didn't match it. And the idea I had about enlightenment, and I'd just written this book that I'm now embarrassed by called Homo Serpiens, as full into my Aeolus Cephas persona as a writer at that time, and I was heavily immersed in occultism. And so I had this idea about enlightenment that I called it the apotheosis of the species and Homo Serpiens, and that it was to do with a human being becoming fully activated, his DNA becoming fully activated, and he would have access to all the memories in the whole universe and all the information in the whole universe, like he'd become this sort of, you know, holographically connected to the whole of existence. And so that was my idea of enlightenment. It was very, you know, it was very mapped out. I wrote a whole book about it. And I met you and you just simply didn't match that. Like you just seemed to be quite an ordinary person who something extraordinary had happened to you, and you seemed to be sort of bumbling your way through. So, and you certainly didn't seem like this mine of you know, the sort of endless esoteric knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge, right? Knowledge. Someone who knows something. Someone who's got a structure. Someone who's got certain kinds of concepts and has built this pyramid that lives up to your expectations that have been given to you to have in the first place.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, as I said already, a lot of what I've gone through knowing you has been deconstructing that pyramid of knowledge that I built in order to ascend and, you know, be the pharaoh on the top of whatever, my will to power occultism. And it's been an incredible relief. It's like I've just been lightening my load over the years through knowing you of all this esoteric stuff. But on the other hand, actually a lot of the stuff that I thought I knew that I didn't know, because I just knew it theoretically because it was passed on through other people's belief systems, some of it's been confirmed through knowing you, I think, although it's a bit hard to say for sure because you are kind of so evasive about this. So, but I bring this to, you know, a specific question about you is like, because you do have knowledge and you do sometimes share knowledge, particularly I'd say on the retreats, there are periods where we go very deep into things and then you will start speaking about things that they more closely approximate my old discarded ideas about enlightenment. Like you seem to have access to much profounder awareness about reality and existence. So my question is something like, what is your experience like in terms of referring to knowledge? Because it seems you clearly don't refer to a knowledge set, and yet you do seem to have access to profound knowledge.
Trying to imagine what you're talking about. I mean, I, you know, like, because right now I don't know if I've got any access to profound knowledge.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a concrete example then. You told me once that you did a lecture and you were talking about ancestors, and at the end this guy came up and said, what about angels? He wanted to hear about angels, and you said something like, well, I can't tell you about angels because I don't have experience of angels. Right? Mm. So Well, I mean, there's two ways to go with that. Like, we could go into the angel thing, or we could go into the ancestor thing. So let's start with the ancestors. When you talk, because you do talk a lot about ancestors, so you must have or feel that you have knowledge of ancestors.
Well, yeah, experiences, and then from experiences come interpretations. And I think that perhaps what's happened with this idea that you attain to knowledge is the idea that you attain to certainty, the idea that there are people who attain to knowledge and they're really certain about it, and the knowledge that they have really maps reality 100%, so it's not even a map anymore. Right? They've actually got it. They've actually clearly can see reality, because otherwise they wouldn't know that their map was real if they couldn't really clearly see reality. And they've been able to put it into a form that is culturally, or they put it into a form that is culturally understandable and can completely map reality. Now, our culture can't map reality. Our language, our concepts, our brains possibly can't even come up with a accurate structured representation of reality. Therefore, that knowledge can't even be attained. And people that claim to have it, well, maybe it's necessary to go and have a little look underneath the Wizard of Oz's curtain to see what Tinky Winky is really up to.
So one thing has occurred to me that we're talking about maps of reality, and I'm not sure if he expressly said this, but it seems to be implied, is if you create a map of reality, you end up mistaking the map for the reality and just interacting with the map, or at best using the map to navigate reality, even if you end up on territory that isn't mapped. So then you just keep referring to the map, even though it's obsolete. And
Or you get a map that's deliberately distorted to make sure that you never end up going anywhere of any consequence.
right, which brings it to the culture. And okay, so like you've referred to your and this interview you just did to how you started meditating at and doing yoga at five, and how you had a sense at five that you weren't who you thought you were. And hopefully I'll bring this around to your enlightenment, because obviously I think it's reasonable to do some sort of correlation between that unusual beginning and where you've ended up now. But before we get to that, I'd like to juxtapose your experience with mine, which is, okay, I don't know about five, I don't really remember, but certainly very early on I had this very deep sense that I wasn't who I thought I was, and that I was living in a dream, or that I was a dream, or that existed anyway. But it was kind of nightmarish, and it didn't lead me to yoga or meditation or to spiritual questioning. It led me to movies, and I ended up immersing myself in these culturally fabricated false realities as a relief to the pressure of not being able to be myself. And obviously there's a lot more to it than that, but just to make this correlation. So I ended up creating, using culture, movies, Clint Eastwood, etc., to create a map for myself. And then I over the years I sort of tried to grow up, but I was always referring to this original map making process, which was using the culture as a reference point. And so then, even when I got into occultism and spirituality, it was in the similar fashion that I was following the same basic template, which was trying to be powerful, trying to create an epic life for myself rather than just really find out who I was. So do you think, I mean, the way that you began your quest so young, you've questioned that all the things you did before you got enlightened, before you had this experience, this unknown experience in June 2000, may have been irrelevant, that you were constantly just trying to work on Dave, and turned out that that was beside the point to actually who you actually were. But it seems that there's got to be a correlation between you actually beginning to question so young and your focus being so much towards finding the truth about yourself, if you juxtapose it with my own path, and you know, and here I am still struggling, you know, to get free of the maps that I created, because they were so enticing and alluring to me. So I feel like I'm still addicted to those maps, whereas it seems as though what you chose, even though that you could say that was also a map because it was spirituality and yoga and all the rest of it, it seems as though it worked for you better than in almost all other cases, if you look around.
There's several parts to answer there. I mean, one is actually what was going on with me. I think I understand what you're saying. And there's a second part to it. It's gone out of my head. That was such a long question. it might come to me anyway. But first of all, what I had was I had a drive. And because I had this unusual experience when I was practicing some yoga moves that I saw on TV, and maybe I was already having that sense that who I seem to be or who I seem to be coming is not really me. I mean, if you think about it, my mind, my personality, my persona, my identity, at the age of 5, they were developing and charging ahead of me. Like, who am I becoming? Who am I? Where did all this come from? I'm like, I'm watching it all happening, and I've got a mind that I'm not in control of. I've got emotions that I'm not in control of. But people around me are telling me, you know, get control of yourself. Smarten up, think straight, act a certain way, don't show your emotions, act this way, you know, be good this way. So I'm being told to do all these things, and I'm trying to get control of this mind that's got a mind of its own, but it's also being conditioned as well. So it's like there's so many cooks with their wooden spoons in the pot, and I don't really quite understand what's going on, but I just knew that that this thing was growing by itself inside of me, but I was able to get some relief from it. I went into a weird zone where there was a gap between me and this self that was developing and my consciousness. That's how I would look back and describe it now. And so the yoga movements gave me that sense, but it doesn't mean that after that that any of the things that I did actually got me to get myself back again, my original self. It doesn't mean any of those things got me back, and maybe they were better than movie watching, but oh, that was maybe the thing. In spiritual groups and in spiritual teachings, that's also an epic template path. They're offering epic templates. I mean, become a Christian and you're being offered a huge epic template to follow and to apply to yourself. Follow Buddhism and there's another huge epic template as well. So any committed religious person is they're believing in epic templates, and they're trying to bash themselves Procrustean style into a form that doesn't in fact fit them. And that's what I was doing for a large part of my spiritual journey. I was trying to fit myself into being a different type of a person, and I also had epic wishes early on. I mean, I was reading Marvel and DC comics and other comics as well. Too embarrassed to say Beano the Dandy, which only your UK viewers will know.
I read those, yeah.
Of course.
Wither and Chips.
Got to start the kids off on, you know, something wholesome. Or not. But anyways, So when I heard about Siddhis and special powers, being able to read minds, walk through walls, disappear at will, I was thinking, well, that would be good to get that too. I wasn't just thinking, I wasn't even clearly thinking what enlightenment was, except for the special powers that it was supposed to confer.
Hmm.
That's what was being sold to me, and that's what I bought. That's not what I have now, and that wasn't what I was looking for in the end. But as a child, that was what was, that was in the books, and it was interesting.
So it wasn't also a relief from the sort of psychic tension of not recognizing who you were, as in, weren't you introduced through this early interest to the idea that yourself, your accustomed self, was an illusion?
Well, the relief from the psychic tension of being beated upon by every person and force and implicit programming that was within society. When I sat down to meditate for a brief spell during my day, I wasn't a school student, I wasn't a child, I wasn't anything. That was the aim of meditation, was to be personless and to be statusless and to be cultureless and to be free of any nation. It's to be space itself. That is the aim of meditation, where you're not being bothered by and pestered by your mind, which has been wound up like a Duracell bunny to beat on you, like the bunny does in the advert with its tin drum when it's two drumsticks. My mind was constantly talking about progress and reputation and the things that I've got to do, and that was a psychic tension, and the meditation was a relief from that, or the aim was to make it a relief from that, except I was trying to meditate really well, and I was looking for the lights, and I was looking for enlightenment, and I was hoping to have a breakthrough, and so I was demoralized by the end of the day when I hadn't achieved enlightenment and knew that I would have to put my school bag on my back the next day, trundle off to school and have my mind filled with stuff that was sometimes interesting, but the whole process of going to school and being in the playground environment, well, you know, it toughens you up, that's all I can say. It's not exactly paradise.
Mm-hmm.
So I got relief from that by engaging in spiritual practices. I felt whenever I went near something spiritual, I had hope in peace, in justice, in fairness, in sanity, in reasonableness, all of the things that we don't actually find in our everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Except in fiction.
Exactly. And that's what religious scripture is, isn't it? It's fiction.
Might have some listeners who would argue with that, but I don't want to get pulled into that just yet. Well, I do have it in my notes.
Well, of course, I'm being extreme, actually. I'm just raising a dialectic.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to this, what you described as something growing inside of you, as in the false self. Because presumably these meditation experiences, even though you said you felt frustrated and that you were failing, they must have offered something to you. I mean, you said there was some kind of relief. So I'm presuming that you had some sense of that they allowed you to feel connected to the thing that was, you felt that was being crowded out by this growing organism of the false self. Like they helped you retain a connection to that which you rediscovered, you know, many, many years later. That's just a guess. Anyway.
Well, I think there's something to your guess. I think there's something on the flip side of the coin. And what that is that the meditation felt like it was slowing down the inevitable demise of my self-control. And by self, I mean my true self, my original self. It was being crowded out, and it was like there was artillery fire hitting the side of a mountain slope that I was hiding on, and the meditation was like going as far away from the artillery fire as possible, going into a quiet, deep and peaceful cave, but eventually having to come out and have breakfast and go to school and do other worldly things. So it was trying, this is my interpretation now, it was trying to thwart and slow down what I didn't want and what I didn't want to become. But I did the meditation to get a break, but also because the meditation was given with a promise, and the promise was to permanently transcend all of this conditioning and having to be a particular person, becoming who I truly am with all my powers and abilities intact. And there's a lot of promise that's what's given to a person when they get involved in a spiritual system that has meditation. Meditation has become separated from spiritual systems, so sometimes people just do it for the relaxation, to tune into themselves or parts of themselves, and to become calm and to become less addicted to things, and to get some deep relaxation once a day. But I wasn't doing it for those reasons. I was doing it because I was offered a carrot, and the carrot was where I would end up. That's why I was doing it. And certainly it was a bit more quiet in there when I went into my meditation state, but I wouldn't be so sure that I was coming closer to what I am. I wouldn't be so sure that I was journeying closer to it, or that I was getting nearer to it. As I say, it was more like delaying the inevitable, which is taking on the mark of the system.
Can understand that. I still think that it's a significant difference. I mean, probably the best way is to juxtapose it with my experience, which is that I also had this sense of being taken over. I mean, with hindsight, I was aware that the false self, as you call it, was taking over my reality, but I didn't have any tools for understanding that. And so what I experienced was was a sense of dissociation or depersonalization, as it's called now, or derealization, as these various different words don't necessarily describe the same thing, but and it was an unbearable feeling to me. And actually meditating would have been the last thing I would have wanted to have done, unless I'd had the tool set or the interpretation system to consider that. Like, I actually, my stepfather was a spiritual seeker, and he did do yoga when I was growing up. I did see him do yoga, and I even learned the lotus position quite young, so it's a weird sort of parallel there with you. But I certainly didn't take it on in any serious way. In fact, I did take him very seriously as a stepfather. I thought of him as like a wizard who knew everything, funny, back to knowledge now, but I didn't take his spiritual thing very seriously, and he didn't try to talk to us about spirituality when we were young. But I've often thought, like, if he had just shared something with me at a very young age, something along the lines of, you know, who you think you are is not who you really are, the relief that that might have given me, because suddenly I'd have had a completely different context to my experience, rather than just there's something wrong with me. That was all I could think. There's something really wrong with me. I must be crazy because everything feels unreal. And therefore I was, you know, the relief that comic books and movies gave me was all I had. Basically, I've just got to try and escape into a totally fake reality so I don't have to experience the disconnect or the derealization of this supposedly real reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, I often say that people that meet with me, I seem to have the same experiences, or I seem to be prepared to understand them. And as I'm listening to you, I completely understand that. I would say that I understand it, because I don't think my life was any different. You're maybe assuming that because I was doing meditation practices that I knew certain things. I didn't. I did the meditation practices because, as I said already, that there was a carrot. There was something being offered to me. And I wasn't. And those spiritual teachings that I initially came across, they weren't saying to me, you're not who you think you are. They're basically saying, you can be this divine self. You can merge with the divine everything everywhere. That's what you really are. Or that, you know, there's different teachings, or you're just a small spark of consciousness, or you're just a drop in the ocean of consciousness, and you can realize what you really are. That's how it was being promoted to me. And guess what? Any of those options seemed better than what I had. But they're fantasy lands. It's like offering heaven to someone. What I was seeing around me growing up in the 80s wasn't very nice. What I saw around me, the feeling wasn't very nice. It didn't look like we were going to have some great rosy future. So something that actually could get me a great future. See, okay, the difference is maybe you had your movies and you had to go into a movie and stay in the movie until the movie wore off. Me, my movie was promised to me in the future, so I kept doing the techniques. I was living in hope that had no disproof. There was nothing could disprove that the things that I was chasing after didn't exist. Whereas you, when the credits roll and you and people start treading over your knees, and then eventually you walk over the broken popcorn on the floor, you know it's over.
Well, I found a way to extend it, sure, the way that you're describing, into the future by writing my own scripts and reviews, and then thinking I'm going to conquer Hollywood. So Hollywood was my heaven.
Yes.
And that was proven to exist. What I didn't understand was that it's not like Valhalla, it's only accessible to the few. But it took so long to kill that Hollywood dream. It was unkillable.
No, of course. It's the Olympics for writers.
Well, and a way to deal with just the unbearable reality, as you say. I mean, I wasn't, I don't know how concerned I was about the state of the world exactly, but I was certainly aware of it. I guess I was concerned because I found it hell, like I was living in hell. So, yeah. But I thought
you would have become a creative if they'd have accepted you, who would have created virtual realities for other people to live within.
Exactly.
Go
yeah.
there, but by the grace of God, don't go you.
Yeah, exactly. I was spared that fate. So let's bring it to the present then, like where you are and where you've been, or if you put it that way, since June, since this thing happened, since 2000. Your journey of zero distance to the discovery of your true nature. Now, throughout the years, I've talked about enlightenment or by other names on this podcast with people. I've had this conversation many times with skeptical people, and it's always come down to the people who are skeptical. Well, I'm sure there's all kinds of skepticism, but the kind I've encountered is intelligent people who are, you know, aware of psychological reality and that they're questing also for an authentic experience of existence. But the argument I always get is that there's no end to it. It couldn't have an end point. Therefore, enlightenment doesn't exist, because enlightenment is some end point. And my counter-argument has always been, well, but if you can see a spectrum of experience, if you know, as I know, as we all know acutely through our lives, that we can have an experience of being inauthentic, of being out of touch with our feelings and our thoughts, lack of, you know, congruity, as you describe it, between the different levels, and that we're basically, you know, just feeling all contorted and twisted in our experience of life. We know what that's like, and we know when it's a little bit better, and we know when it's a lot better. And so there must be, and we, you know, there's a point where it's just absolutely unbearable, where we'd have to leave the room. So there's, you know, there's a negative end of that spectrum. So why wouldn't there be, you know, a final realization where everything is completely congruent and one has landed in the moment? It's always seemed to me completely logical or illogical to try and deny this idea, regardless of whether you call it enlightenment or awakening or actualization or what have you, right? So then you've had this experience and you've described it, and so that confirms this thing. But there's a sort of paradox in your description, because you've described it as a journey of zero distance, and that there aren't steps and stages therefore, and yet you've also talked about a daily decrease, and this has been my experience, having not attained what seems to be the final shift, the one you can't go back on. My experience is of a daily or a weekly or a monthly or a decrease of distortion, like in my being, in my body and in my psyche. So it does feel through knowing, not just through knowing you, but it's been much more palpable and observable through knowing you, that I've been getting progressively, incrementally closer to a full experience of myself. So, I mean, is there a contradiction in that? Is that a paradox, or is it just like a misperception that I'm having, or am I just creating a conflict between these two interpretations in my mind there?
Well, I don't remember what I meant by a journey of zero distance, unfortunately. But what I think what I meant by it, at least minimally, is that what you're looking for isn't away from you. Therefore, there's no distance to it. I'm not talking about the fact that you might spend years having loads of experiences and from your point of view, you're getting nearer to something. Myself, personally, I didn't have the experience of getting nearer to myself. I wasn't aware that I was getting nearer to myself. I wasn't aware that I was getting nearer to enlightenment. And when I got enlightened, it wasn't like anything that I'd experienced before. It was of an altogether different order. So when people say to me that they feel that they're getting nearer to it, or they know that they're getting nearer to it, well, I have no precedent for that, And in some cases, people think that something's going to happen and it doesn't. In other cases, I have people around me who have become enlightened 35 times and then decided it wasn't enlightenment. So there's all kinds of possibilities. And it's really not my right to deny someone's claims about themselves. And if someone says that they're getting nearer to it, well, it's not for me to really disavow them. The only thing that I'm interested in is where I can help a person. And if they come to me and they say, look, I'm having trouble sorting this out, well, I'll work through it with them.
Mm.
There was other stuff in there, but again, you said so many things that there's so many threads and I can't necessarily remember all of them right now.
Yeah, I understand. They're not really meant to be... I mean, they are meant to end with a question, but...
Well, there's plenty in there. There's plenty in there. But the other thing I was going to say is, and this is really important to get clear, that some of the things that you threw in, some of the language like self-actualization and things like that, and also you having conversations with people and they say it never ends, right? Now, the thing is, I'm not seeing enlightenment as some finish line in a race. It's not in front of you, enlightenment. It's what you left behind. And if you left somewhere, you can return to it. It's not something that's in the future. It's not something that you build towards. It's not something that you build upon. I mean, you can, of course, you know, after you get enlightened, you recover yourself. That's what getting enlightened means. It simply means you recovered yourself. And you recover yourself when you throw off certain misperceptions about yourself and how you relate to yourself, and you're not caught up in your mind's virtual reality. So you're returning to your original consciousness. It's not something apart from you. It's not something that you journey towards. It's not something that you have to do meritorious actions to achieve. And it isn't something that goes on forever. You either get back to who you are or you don't get back to who you are. It's binary.
Hmm.
Now, there is an interplay, of course, between your mind and your consciousness. And so your mind might become a bit clearer. You might make some more realizations. But this absolute change in identification, you are identified with ideas about yourself that have been only acquired after you were born.
Hmm.
So you're either identified with them or you're not. It doesn't get better or worse than that. It isn't like I get more enlightened. Now you can, of course, drop some of your beliefs. In that sense, you could say you're becoming more enlightened in a way, but for me, there was this complete change on a particular day, and it's still the same change, and I didn't have it the day before, and then I had it the day afterwards, and that change doesn't change. It's a bit like if you want to boil an egg and you heat your water to 100 degrees Celsius, it stays at 100 degrees Celsius. Your egg might get cooked, but your water's not going to get any hotter.
Mm-hmm.
So the egg will change, but the water won't. It will just evaporate. It's not going to get any hotter.
Mm.
And it's becoming steam. That's the change.
Right. But steam can go back to water, can't it?
Yes, that's where the metaphor breaks down.
That's always the point.
Well, and maybe a person can become unenlightened. It's just I haven't felt it. It's a bit like once you've seen that the Wizard of Oz is this short, balding guy, It's a bit hard to unsee it and go, yes, I believe the wizard exists. I've heard his voice.
Well, the wizard, of course, had a backup plan there for his exposure. He still got to be the wizard.
So okay.
They wanted to believe.
He tied himself. Well, sure. And people can tie themselves into becoming indispensable for all the wrong reasons and still keep their throne even once they've been, unsmocked, defrocked, that's it, defrocked.
To be clear, I wasn't saying, I don't think I was saying I'm getting closer to enlightenment, because I think that would be very, very presumptuous.
No, but you might be. Maybe you might be also.
Well, but I wouldn't. I mean, if you don't know what something is, if you haven't experienced something, you can't know what it is, and you can't know if you're getting closer
to it
or not. So what I can say is that I feel like I'm getting closer and closer, just feeling at home in my body and in my life, and at ease and at peace with existence. And there does seem to be a correlation between that experience, that ongoing experience, and a letting go of beliefs about myself and about reality. Which, I mean, it doesn't mean I'm not adopting new ones. So I think that that's maybe a key distinction. It doesn't necessarily count to let go of beliefs, because we can just replace them. Mm. But to actually become less sticky.
Yeah, because you're not so tied in, and perhaps other people aren't as fortunate as you, that they feel that they're tied into behaving a certain way, following a certain news, information, studies, pretending to be a certain type of persona. They may feel that that's necessary for their economic or even their physical survival, whereas you and some of us, we detached ourselves from feeling that we had to be a certain way. My own personal journey was about showing myself I didn't have to be the way that I used to think I had to be. I didn't have the limitations that I thought, or I didn't have to be afraid of the things that I thought I had to be afraid of. Constantly testing and pushing through my limits and my ideas about myself, and I found out I wasn't this fixed character. That perhaps weakened my ideas about who I was, but also I didn't care to stay who I was, and I wasn't invested in developing the persona that I had and bowing down to people so that I could get some of the gelt. So you're probably the same in your life. So you're fortunate that you don't have to be a certain way. You're not trying to climb a certain ladder and conform yourself more and more into being a perfect poster boy for, you know, whatever, you know, script writers or whatever, or whatever it is. You're not tied in now. You're ruminating around, kicking rocks and stones and looking underneath and questioning things. That's very different from trying to become someone. And when you try to become someone, that's where you get, you know, that's when you get the concrete boots again, or you get the millstone around your neck and you go back down into the cesspit.
Well, I think I was always trying to become someone, but I think that it always had to be on my own terms. That as in, I was only willing to become someone that I'd invented, you know, like my own Frankenstein's monster. And they weren't personas that really were very wieldy, and I had to keep discarding them. But there was that distinction, I think, that you're making, was that I never wanted to refer to outside criteria, you know, about what had value or meaning. It's not to say that I didn't, because I was in the culture and I wasn't doing it in a vacuum. But there was always this, I think there was always a sense of experimenting. I think there always was throughout my process. Certainly Being the One was an experiment. You know, even wanting to be Clint Eastwood or trying to be David Byrne. These were things I didn't really believe I was going to pull off. They were like, let's try this on and see if it fits. And of course, as you know, John DeRuta, that was a very public experiment that I got to see, you know, how poorly, what happens when I, you know, when it doesn't fit, when the thing that I'm trying on doesn't fit. So there's been that ongoing process, I think, has been fruitful for me, and I think it got something in common with what you've described in your life, what you talk about as social enlightenment, which you describe as facing your fears, that for me are often the part of the experiment was, well, this is frightening to me, so let's do it and see what happens, see if there's really a reason to be afraid.
Yeah, social enlightenment, I mean, for those who might not understand that pithy concept, because I've used it years ago and you've obviously remembered it, but social enlightenment is feeling socially liberated, like you could do anything, which is not a very ethical, it's not based in ethics at all. Social enlightenment is, I don't have to follow anything I've been told to follow. No morality, no ethics, nothing. It's social liberation. It's not necessarily becoming who you truly are, but it's sticking two fingers up at everything you've ever been told that you have to be and throwing it all out. Well, you don't necessarily know who you are, and you could get very heady on your own sense of personal power and your own trip that you're on, but you know, that's like a teenage stage.
And I think perhaps one key difference between your path and mine is that for me, the social liberation that went on that teenage stage, which went on for decades, was one thing. It went on a lot longer, I think, but it also involved a lot of practices that took their toll physically for me. Like, I think you were very aware of your body and not putting shit in your body, and I just didn't give a shit about that. Well, I didn't consider it. I was health diet conscious a little bit, but in terms of the amount of psychedelics and anything I did, and even the occult, as might say, has some sort of a feedback loop that it creates in the psyche and the body, I think, taking on all that stuff. I think it took a heavy toll on my body, and that's my sense. I mean, because you said, well, you didn't feel that you were going to get enlightened before you got enlightened, but you have said that you, in the period leading up, you were much more in tune with your body, that you became much more aware of the interiority of your body.
Yeah, I mean, that was a change, but again, like, I wasn't following a particular diet and a particular lifestyle because I was necessarily aware of what is healthy and what produces healthy feeling. I was doing it because I was told. I was told, you follow this diet, you follow this lifestyle, and you'll get enlightened. And I was aware that some things would damage me, like I knew that if I drank alcohol it would kill my brain cells, and if I did boxing and I got punched drunk, then I would also not have a very functional nervous system. So I wanted to avoid anything that would damage my chances of becoming enlightened. You see, everything was about becoming enlightened. As I become more sensitive, and particularly those 2 years before I became enlightened, then I became more aware of what is healthy for my system and what is unhealthy for my system. And so I had another level of throwing off the yoke. Whereas before, the yoke that I threw off was all of the ideas about how I should be. The new throwing off was internal tensions in my body, in my nervous system, in my organs. I was able to find them, realize that they're there, and to throw them off. So it's throwing off a much deeper level of patterning and programming, because the real patterning and programming goes on in your nervous system, in the parts of yourself that are become reflexes, and you can't get control of. And that's when people can be made to cry on command or crumple a mean word or a shout or something like that. That's where people are really powerless against the conditioning that they've been through. It's pre-verbal and it's pre-thought or their ability to conceptualize what's going on to them. So I was unwinding at a deeper level than I had before by going into my body and becoming more sensitive. So then I could identify what certain lifestyle practices were doing, whereas before I was just following them.
There's a thing that I read in this book about Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he has a sort of biological model for enlightenment, which I won't go into, but it might interest you. But anyway, I guess I will just mention that he writes about it as something that's supposed to happen in adolescence, and that's why we always have this sense of as adolescents, pre-adolescence, is something enormous that's going to happen to us, because it's hardwired into us that actually the body, brain, heart system is supposed to come fully activated and fully harmonious at that age, and it doesn't happen because of culture. That's essentially his model. But the reason I brought it up was that he reported some tests that they did on infants, that as they learn language, it goes into the body, because they develop actual physical tics associated with different words and so on.
And subvocalization goes on as well, which is movements in the voice box. Right? So the body's moving when you think words.
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to go with that, but why I brought it up was this idea that I may have got from you. I know you don't like to give people ideas, but it may be an example of something that I kind of innately felt or sensed or thought I knew that was confirmed through relating with you. But this idea that the false self, that it's something that, although it sounds like an abstract concept, it isn't necessarily an abstract concept, because it's something that may actually be installed in the body in some way, or embedded in the body and in the nervous system. And you've seen, you know, my demonstration of the Grinch. I've described, and I've even demonstrated to you what I refer to as the Grinch, that was, you know, later diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome, but began in my very early 20s, which was when my identity, my false identity, was most concretized, when I was most believing that actually this was going to be my vehicle to happiness, this false identity. It was going to take me to Hollywood and all the rest of it. And that was the period that these symptoms began. And it's actually, you know, not a million miles away from the Christian idea of possession or, you know, a satanic influence. But the difference is, I'd say, was that for me it was absolutely physiological.
You know? Yes, that's my interpretation, that's my model. I don't necessarily see it as just physical. That would be a reductionistic model. But reductionism is the bottom line that we can all normally agree on. That's what we're trained to believe in. And it's also, we tend to talk about what we can see. That's the very least that we can get everyone to agree upon. My sense of this false self isn't just related to the body. But of course, if we were to come up with a hard or soft science theory, then we would just put it in the body. But certainly, for me, the key was making journeys through my body with my awareness. I wasn't, you know, ripping it out physically, and bringing that awareness into my body was key to changing blockages, roadblocks, compartmentalization, distortion, numbness, noise, stress, all kinds of aberrations. That if you was a network engineer on a computer network, you'd be looking for noise in the cables and power leakages where the signal just attenuates for no known reason. You'd be looking for things like that. And inside of my body, inside of my energy system, remember, you've maybe heard the expression, of course, when you're growing up, a sound mind in a sound body. Well, what does that really mean? It sounds kind of musical as well. If you've got a good musical instrument, it will carry sound very faithfully. with a lot of different tones in it, but if the musical instrument is cracked or hardened or blocked inside or inflexible, then it maybe won't carry the sound very faithfully, and it won't have all of these different tones inside it. So it's all interpretation about where it's all really happening, but the very least that we can agree on is that it's definitely happening inside the body. We feel inside the body. I mean, for me now, it's absolutely obvious that a person, when they're thinking, when they're feeling, when they're feeling blocked, when they're having issues, it's all coming from their body, but also it's spatially arranged, and that space also includes the physical space outside of their body. So when I observe someone and I see that they're constantly going towards depressing thoughts, I see that they're accessing certain spaces around their body where they've got their toxic dump of depressing stuff, and when their awareness goes to a different area of their body or outside of their body, a different zone, they aren't feeling depressed, and they're not aware of how they're accessing that. So helping a person become aware of what they're doing and how memories, how programming, how mechanisms are arranged inside them, all of that gives them more choice about whether they want to jettison it. But the thing is that making that choice, no one can be forced to make that choice. Do they want to give up the old system that is running through their veins, the old personality that the personality that they've been working on? Do they want to give it up? That's like asking someone to give up their credit card. The credit card might give them lots of problems, but it seems to give them safety.
Okay, so that ends the first part of my conversation with Dave O'Shana. There will be four parts in all, and they will be airing over the next 2 weeks. Next part will be up on Wednesday the 26th, part three, Saturday the 29th, and the fourth and final part on Wednesday the 3rd of October. For those who don't know, Dave O'Shana is appearing in Maine at the 26th of September and the days thereafter for an intensive. You can find the details about that daveoshana.com or follow the link in the show notes. I realized after I had this conversation with Dave, which it took many years to actually bring about, feel ready to do, and which I felt very excited about sharing, that it actually will be airing September 22nd, exactly 10 years and 1 month after my first ever podcast, The Stormy Weather Number 1, Something Ain't Right, with Kerry McCoy. So make of that what you will, I don't know, sort of a completion of a cycle, which indicates the beginning of a new phase, perhaps. Actually, I'm going to be talking to Kerry McCoy this week, so keep tuning in. Encourage you to check out Dave for yourself, and so you can read about my experiences interacting, participating with Dave's project over the last 10 years, give or take, at my blog and website, horticulture.com. If you'd like to donate, please do so via the usual channels. And also keep an eye out for a workshop course thing that I'm putting together for probably October through December on Applied Liminality, which will be called God's Lonely People. This is Jason Horsley wishing you a very happy, peaceful and enjoyable existence. You might think this is God.
God, nothing to do with you. But it has.